Sometimes, reality is too complex for oral communication, but legend embodies it in a form which enables it to spread all over the world, or all over the galaxy. This is Cinemaville. Today we reach number 12 on the Wonders in the Dark Sci-Fi Countdown, and my last installment for it. Star Wars, Episode 4, A New Hope, written and directed by George Lucas in 1977. I'll talk about this instant classic and its various legacies with fellow Wonders contributor Joel Bacco, but before we get to that, I feel obliged to begin the program with a few words on another untimely passing. Last time, it was Wonders co-founder Alan Fish, and this time, well, it's the movies themselves. At least that's what everybody seems to be saying nowadays on the film Twitter cinematic universe. And I've no doubt that Fish, were he still with us, would be nodding his head every so often in shared disapproval for the sorry state of affairs modern cinephilia exists in the year of our Lord, 2016. Much ado has already been made of the overwhelming glut the box office has been experiencing at the hands of a never-ending avalanche of superhero movies, something that nobody seemed to mind when the relative high-water marks of Deadpool and Civil War were the worst they had to worry about, but not so easily ignored after the torrential downpour of Batman vs. Superman, X-Men Apocalypse, and Suicide Squad. Some of these movies are examples of filmmakers and actors being allowed to more or less do what they want within the confines of a bloated studio system. Deadpool was an unlikely passion project not only for its director, but Ryan Reynolds as well. And director Bryan Singer seems to have accepted his calling as the protector of mutant kind as readily as the headmaster of Professor Xavier's School for the Gifted. But the rest of the time, these movies have stood as examples of corporate studio interference at its worst and most ubiquitous, even when they succeed. DC's increasingly awkward attempts to marry the steely, mythic iconography of their heroes with the dour, Frank Miller-inspired bleakness of the Zack Snyder house style has been a difficult ride, but Marvel's flawless track record with audiences only masks how impersonal and yeoman-like the actual creative side is on their superhero fantasies, resulting in slick and professional presentations that never really offer anything personal. We're far from the days of Lucas and Spielberg or James Cameron weaving their own original myths on the screen, and surprisingly distant from even the likes of a Sam Raimi or Christopher Nolan putting their individual stamp on existing characters. Now, we really do seem to be stuck with a box office that's mired in crass, impersonal corporate product, designed to please fans and wow crowds and turn a buck more than elicit awe, wonder, or maybe even provoke an emotion that doesn't come with positive overtones. Nearly every big draw, successful or attempted, of the past summer in theaters has been based on a corporate-owned existing product, from Spider-Man to Ghostbusters, and looking forward to Star Wars and live-action Disney adaptations for the foreseeable future. Everything old isn't new again, but it's basically all we have. And the picture isn't that much better on television, either. So much of the conversation-hogging material, be it streaming or broadcast, is so enthralled by the specter of existing properties, either by adapting them or channeling their spirits, that the pop culture obsession with nostalgia has gone from something resembling not so much a seasonal flu, but an all-out year-long pandemic. The so-called golden age of television has always had a problem with the past. Mad Men and Downton Abbey aren't just the tip of the iceberg, they're just the ice cubes on it. But as of late, Everything from Stranger Things to The Americans seems obsessed with recreating the 1980s, just as Generation X starts pushing past the point of no return on middle age, with millennials not that far behind on the mission creep of maturity with 90s-obsessed series like The People vs. O.J. Simpson and Mr. Robot. And the new remakes of existing properties like Westworld on HBO, and even more Marvel shows on Netflix, only exacerbates an exponentially growing problem. Now, some of these shows I like. In fact, Stranger Things is really the only one I'm cold on, to be honest. And to an extent, I can admire the way each of these programs individually examines both an aspect of the past and the very idea of the past itself. But all of them happening at the same time worries me. And as Joel and I will get into in our talk on Star Wars, some of this Orpheus-like tendency to stare backwards into the past began with homage enthusiasts like Lucas and Tarantino and Hideki Anno, for that matter. And the fact that he's made a new Godzilla movie only complicates this problem even further. But we've never been this satisfied with references in and of themselves, without needing to have much in the way of creative reassembly to show us something new about them, let alone ourselves. The best directors and writers manage, or at the very least attempt it, but the most successful don't even need to bother about it themselves. They don't have to convert anybody when they're preaching to the choir. Now, this is where I would love to pivot on the dire circumstances of mere entertainment and point a path ahead to the streaming roses and wafting peach blossom chemtrails of the glorious art house, represented by the newly ushered New York Film Festival, just approaching its second weekend. And with any luck, I'll find something of genuine worth in the movies I'm looking forward to in the rest of this year's lineup. But if the Cannes crowd pleaser and Lincoln Center audience favorite Tony Erdmann is any indicator, then we are all well and truly fucked. Marin Ade's film about the troubles and tribulations of a young German corporate middlewoman juggling the demands of her increasingly amoral job and her compulsively free-spirited father, Tony Erdmann is a movie that tries to capture the same anarchic transgressive spirit of a Lars von Trier comedy of agonizing awkward errors, mixed with the trenchant social realism of a drama by the Dardenne brothers. Unfortunately, what it really winds up resembling is the German language equivalent of a quaint American indie dramedy, with equal amounts gross-out humor and family-values-affirming schmaltz to help support a familiar narrative of an uptight businesswoman who just needs to let her hair down, and in this case, every trace of her clothing, to embrace a life that's fuller, freer, and just plain better, just like her hippy-dippy dad. It's the sort of movie that, in America, would have starred Robin Williams back before he died, and everybody would have hated it. Now, this isn't the first time I haven't seen eye to eye with the predominant audience approval of a movie at the New York Film Festival. I spent most of my time watching Holy Motors somewhere between bored and perplexed. But this is maybe the first time I've ever thought that a movie not only got a free pass, but a complimentary first-class ticket, because it came with subtitles. If this same movie were made in America, I doubt it would have received any more than a bare trace of a nod from the mumblecore appreciation crowd before heading straight to Netflix purgatory for the duration of Western civilization. Now, to an extent, this is the sort of thing that we're all aware of to varying degrees. Hollywood may be dumb, with American indies and foreign cinema a smidge smarter, but to a large extent, both are equally devoid of true standouts that will stand the test of time. The diamonds have always been in the rough and only found when sieved through mountains of sand. It's just easier to be aware of the sheer abundance of sand now, ever since everything has a half-life of forever sitting on a digital shelf alongside all the genuine masterpieces. So, maybe it just means we have to develop a stricter attention span, both for retaining the best as it comes along, and shooing the rest towards the memory hole. And so far, all I've even talked about is live action. There's a whole other conversation waiting to be had about the renaissance of animation, both at home and abroad, with 2016 being a particularly good year for it. A lot of oxygen has already been sucked out of the room by the adult fare of Sausage Party, and also the problems it's had in figuring out how to actually pay the animators who worked on it. But besides that, there's all sorts of gems to be found. When I grow weary of the greatest hits pop culture tropes hogging the limelight on Netflix and basic cable, I remember shows as daring and original as Gravity Falls or Steven Universe, which seems to be single-handedly making cartoons not just a safe place for LGBTQ and awkward kids, but practically a national territory. And when I'm chilly at the thought of the near-standing ovation Tony Erdman got, I remember April and the Extraordinary World, and think of the vibrant state of animation around the world. I can even appreciate the bright spots of an otherwise dreary corporate lineup at places like Disney when you consider things like Zootopia, or Laika Studios' Kubo and the Two Strings. Hell, even something as fishy as Warner Storks has gotten a rave or two, and that might not make any sense to me, but who am I to argue? I really shouldn't be arguing about any of this, really. But if I'm going to, at least I'm going to be open to finding gems and trash anywhere I can find them. As Alan Fish might have observed, God damn us, everyone. And now, it's time for Star Wars. Again, this conversation is between myself and Joel Bacco, contributor to Wonders in the Dark, and video essayist over at Lost in the Movies. Let's get going.
Just out of curiosity, when was the last time that you, like, sat down and watched this movie?
Probably when I did the whole marathon back in January. Interestingly, and I'll talk about this in the interview, that was not the most enjoyable way for me to watch it.
Yeah,
I prefer watching it as a standalone.
Yeah, I mean, like, for me, marathoning these movies always sounds like a good idea, but it's just so exhausting. And I've only ever marathoned just, like, the prequel movies together, because even by the time, like, I get to, like, Sith, you're so drained that,
let's be honest, it's such a switch.
Yeah.
Sith to New Hope, or, you know, which I guess if you're watching it in that order, you're going to call it A New Hope.
Yeah.
It's such a dramatic shift. Even with the special edition, with the CGI added, it feels so different.
Well, I think in one sense, it's just, like, the contrast from, like, 3 to 4. It's just the contrast of, like, absolute bleakness and, you know.
Yeah, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, like, that, you know, it would be like saying, you know, you're going to watch Evangelion and you're going to go from end of Evangelion to both of you dance it like you want to win. That's basically what the contrast
totally
is.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. I've always
Or like, you know, going from Twin Peaks like it actually does, going from like the end of the mystery and especially the murder and then just getting into all the goofy stuff like immediately.
Yeah, that's
actually created that way, which is the weird part about it. Like the other stuff. You know.
Oh man, now I'm going to always think of Darth Vader not as, you know, Darth Vader the cool bad guy. Now I'm going to always think of him as Anakin in his plaid Cooper phase.
That's an interesting reading.
Yeah, Star Wars and George Lucas's like directing style and his directing caliber reminds me of, like, Fritz Lang when he was in Hollywood.
Well,
never at his best, but always,
okay.
You know, putting some big stamp on stuff. Like, you know, say,
sure.
I would compare it between,
Metropolis THX is like Metropolis.
Yeah.
And
then,
Star Wars is like Fury or something like that.
Or like Hangmen Also Die. Yes,
yeah.
Hangmen Also Die on one end, which I think is...
You only live once.
Right, it's like a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
But
and it's got that visual
people,
strikingness.
Right, and it's got that visual strikingness.
Not on the level of...
But it's not terribly well acted. Then you compare it to, say, something like Casablanca, which is a Hollywood classic. Everybody acting in it is great. The script is cobbled together and stitched together like a Frankenstein's monster, but everybody loves it.
It gels, yeah.
Yeah, it gels. And Michael Curtiz corrals everybody very nicely.
Yeah.
But I can't remember one single fucking shot in that movie by the time it's done.
Yeah.
I'm definitely not.
I love Casablanca, but I was going to make that same comparison, though.
Yeah.
I think Empire Strikes Back, absolutely. I think Star Wars is like, if you're going to, you know, and I guess this will offend people, but whatever, if you make any analogy, because I was going to say, you know, Star Wars is Citizen Kane and the Empire is Casablanca.
That's not necessarily a bad one.
The only problem I have, and we'll get to this in this, or I guess I'll get into it now, is much as I love Star Wars, I don't think its strongest point, and we've actually sort of gone back and forth over this. I mean, I don't know if you agree more than me now or if you still kind of disagree, but I don't at all think its strongest point is formally. I don't think it has fantastic compositions or in the way that THX does. THX, to me, is a masterfully visually directed film. Star Wars, I think the special, and, you know, we mentioned this before, the special effects shots, I think, are some of the most visually graphically striking shots in the movie. Obviously, the big first one with the Star Destroyer coming in overhead. Most of the stuff with actors, I think, is satisfactory. I wouldn't call it, like, you know, hack work, whatever, but it's not up to the level of THX in terms of visual interest. It's more people sitting and talking in interesting places. I think it's a movie that what's rich about it is what is on screen rather than how it's on screen.
That's my
take on it. And this is, as you know, a movie I love, but I think that's kind of where I'm at with that. I think I love Star Wars. To me, it's almost like concept art. Like, I love it. There's just something conceptually about the whole existence of the thing, almost intangible. It's the idea of Star Wars is just, and it manifests itself on screen, but sort of indirectly.
Well, here's where I am on the formal qualities of it. I think between the time that, like, I saw it, like, the last time I've talked about this with you, I've done a lot of reading of, like, Art Spiegelman's comics in the past.
Yeah.
Have you ever read Mouse?
Yes.
Have you ever read any of his other comics?
I don't think so. Maybe, like, a short one, probably part of an anthology or something like that, you know. But I don't think I've sat down and read, like, a whole graphic novel of his other than Mouse.
Well, he doesn't have any other graphic novels other than Mouse, but he does have, like, a lot of very large, like, compilations of his work. And probably the best one to look for is, like, Breakdowns, which is, like, which collected basically all of his pre-Mouse graphic novel work.
Yeah.
And he was very, like, avant-garde, very abstract and experimental. He was as experimental with the form at that point as of comics as George Lucas was when he was doing THX and some of his shorts. By the time he did Mouse, though, when you first look at Mouse, it is much, much, much less aesthetically daring and interesting or experimental than his other work. Like, if you look at, like, some of the work that he's done, like Don't Get Around Much Anymore or As the Mind Reels or some of his other things, or, like, Prisoner on the Hell Planet, which is a story he actually has reprinted inside the graphic novel of Mouse, so you can see that contrast between one stage of his art to another. It's much more straightforward. It has kind of a scratchy quality to it. The central idea is one that's interesting at first, but you get used to after a while and don't even think about as, like, you know, you know, Jews are drawn as mice, Germans
right.
are drawn as cats, and Poles as pigs,
etc. It doesn't just remain a gimmick. It's like
right.
the gimmick kind of gets you into it, and then you either like it or don't based on the
right,
the
right, and,
of it. Yeah.
Right, and then like the rest of it,
it's pretty similar.
Like right, the rest of it feels very aesthetically conventional in a lot of ways.
Yes.
It's just like
yeah.
using it as a way to record his father's experiences
yeah.
from the war.
But
the but, more, right, but here's the thing. The
sure.
more I have looked at that book, and
yeah.
especially in conjunction with some of his other work,
yeah.
The more you start to see the seams and where he's playing with form in ways that you're not always aware of on a first level. Like, say, there's
yeah.
one panel transition where he's talking about, where his father is talking about an experience that he had at Auschwitz. And
yeah.
one panel shows a close-up of, you know, the, you know, sinister factory chimneys, the death chimneys of Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And in the panel right above it, and I only noticed this on, like, my second or third read, you
yeah.
have a close-up of Art Spiegelman's hand as he's, like, talking to his father, documenting this, with a cigarette
mm-hmm.
in his hand. So what you have is the cigarette smoke rising from the death chimney. And that was something that when I first looked at it and thought, oh, that's interesting. But then you realize how that's linking past and present. And going
yeah.
back and looking at, like, an interview, you realize that was an absolutely 100% intentional moment.
Oh, yeah.
So, and there are moments like that throughout Mouse.
Yeah.
And so after a while, I realized you can't take for granted
yes,
when okay. somebody is going from, like, you know, and that's something that I think is similar between the two of them, between Spiegelman and Lucas.
Yep.
They learned how to follow the rules by breaking them, by deconstructing all of them, and then saying, okay, now that I've broken all the rules, I'm going to put them back together in the order that I see fit.
That's
and
a
when
great
I,
analogy.
Yeah, and when
okay.
I looked, and when I looked at, like, when I looked at Star Wars this time, A New Hope, yeah, I mean, I can see the limitations of what he's playing with, and I can see the limitations of the studio style, but
yeah.
I'm also a lot more keenly aware of how
mm-hmm.
he's using the limited resources that he has.
Yeah,
how he's
totally
using,
agree.
Right,
totally
like, say,
agree.
The very first shot, I realized, like, just thinking about it and, like, looking at, you know, stills and things, I realized that that shot is actually one of the first in Star Wars of something that he repeats throughout the whole thing. It's a very, very heavy perspective shot.
Yeah.
You know, like, once the ship starts going for a while, it really is almost receding right into the vanishing point. And the way the ship is constructed, the way that shot is constructed, is very much to emphasize the clean, sheer
yeah.
lines. So
yes.
it becomes a shot that's very, you know, that is just like, you know, the hyperspace shot, just like all those shots on the Death Star, of those bottomless pits that go on forever, or the
yeah.
trench. This is where he's using the same lessons that he learned on THX, because perspective shots and speedline shots are everywhere on that movie.
I was going to say, I think that's a very good analogy, a very good point. And I guess the way I would state it is this. I don't think Star Wars definitely isn't as flashy. It's not quite as visually creative as THX. However, it's substantially more visually creative and interesting and sort of almost like a textbook. You can look and just be like, oh, yes, this is how, you know, it just straightforwardly but inventively to photograph action and photograph, you know, conversations and cut it together, too. I think that's the other thing. The editing
yeah.
is sort of the same thing. It's like a subtle, it's not a flashy type of editing, but it's very, very competent and well done. And that level is high, high above much of what you would see today, I think, in terms of blockbuster filmmaking.
Oh,
certainly if something fairly generic, like from what I've seen, you know, I've missed a lot of them, but like the Marvel stuff, you know, people have just critiqued how it's just, and honestly, somebody like Peter Jackson, who does have a very distinct style, but I think kind of a terrible one, where it's just this constantly whirling camera and there's nothing. And Lucas is very anchored, and that's something you see in the prequels as well that I really appreciate and that irritated me about the whole Red Letter Media takedown where they do whoever is Mr. Plinkett's Star Wars, one part which is just so disingenuous, where he says he's making fun of Lucas as an editor, basically saying he's an incompetent hack as an editor, which runs contrary to everything that anybody who has worked with him says. Whatever their other criticisms of him, they're like, this guy, and obviously his wife as well, you know, were top notch. Like, he got editing on a gut level. And, you know, even some of them are like, oh, he even, you know, editors Dwayne Dunham, who edited Twin Peaks and Blue Velvet, just is in awe of Lucas as an editor. Now, the ridiculous thing is, he takes selected footage from one of the making of documentaries.
Yeah,
and I watched the actual documentary, and this is how I knew what he was doing. He goes, you know, he does his Mr. Plinkett voice, and he's like, oh, Lucas... Well, you know, he does a boring way of cutting the scene, and they cut to Richard Chu, and Richard Chu is going, I got in and I looked, and everything was just standard, master shot, cut in for close-up, very boring way of doing it, and he's using shots from, like, you know, the prequels to illustrate how Lucas is doing that. I saw the actual documentary. Richard Chu is not talking about how George Lucas cut the film. He's talking about how the previous editor...
Jimson.
Yes, Jimson, yes, the previous editor, how the previous editor had cut it, and how Lucas was unsatisfied with that and wanted to do it in a much more dynamic way. So that's just so dishonest, to take that, and to take somebody who is actually defending Lucas's editing skills and use that in this video, which has millions of views, to, you know, try and weasel it that this guy is knocking Lucas. I just thought, what a cheap shot. So anyway, I wanted to get that out there. I do think, to a certain extent, there may be too many master shots. There may be too many sort of mediums. I think, yeah, I can grant that at times. I think whenever there's a conversation, and actually Richard Brody talked about this really well, and pretty much what was like a rave review, you know, where he's like, you know, well, all the first films suck, but man, Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith were amazing, just masterpieces. And, you know, and he basically makes the point of, like, things do kind of come to a halt when people are speaking. There's not the same visual invention isn't there. I would agree with that, but I think I would rather see him shoot those scenes the way he did than have, like, a whirling camera surrounding them just for the sake of movement, which I think is ridiculous and overused. And
just the fact that Lucas... even to this day, has shot things largely in long shots or medium long shots and only goes in for a close-up when it's really important.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that I vastly prefer to the modern conventions of, let's shoot close-ups for everything.
Yeah, oh, I agree.
Or,
with
like,
that.
You know, I can't tell you how many...
I don't think you should cut unless you have to, last resort.
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell you how many action movies are rendered unintelligible, not necessarily by shaky cam, but shaky cam on a close-up. You know, and it's
so
like, and there are so many movies that, like, even the better movies in, like, the Marvel canon,
sure,
when you're shooting, when, like, a medium shot is your longest shot possible, and you're only going to go to a long shot because you've been given an IMAX camera for this scene or something, and a character is about to become, like, as tall as a skyscraper,
yeah,
it's going to lead to some pretty pedestrian-looking action. And at the very least, in every stage of his career, whenever Lucas is shooting something, especially when he's shooting in long shots and medium shots,
yeah,
you're going to be able to understand and tell what's going on at any
yeah
given point in a scene. And this is something that I was appreciating the last time I watched A New Hope on the big screen, and I still was able to appreciate it now, was like that, say, like all of the shootouts, the laser shootouts in this movie are really well composed, really, like, I think that there you see some of his experimental side a bit more clearly than you might say during Conversations, because you know, in a couple of scenes you have like these very tight frames on these people who are all about to be shot and killed. And
yeah,
you'll have, like, lots of negative space in one shot, and then when you return to that shot, the negative space will wind up being filled by bodies. So there's
yeah
something really interesting about that, but also in the way that, you know, there's a very intelligible use of foreground, background, layering in the way that, like, Ridley Scott would do later on just for set dressing and background detail. You know, you get all of these like bits and things in a sequence in their separate layers. It's so neatly composed, and like it's almost keyframed in an animation term. You can tell each step of the process really quickly and cleanly. And the fact that you have like the flashing laser lights and everything makes all the action even more intelligible than you might have for, say, a Western or a James Bond movie, where you'll know that somebody's shooting, but you don't see the exact arc of their shot.
Right, that's a good point.
Right. And, you know, even like, you know, to get back to like perspective lines, after a while, all those laser blasts become a kind of perspective line themselves. So it's a way to organize the geography of the scene. And something that I noticed this time while watching it, whenever the stormtroopers are shooting at, you know, the rebels, and whenever their blasts hit and like hit the wall or something, you get a single frame of just like magenta or something like that cut into the action, so that you're feeling the impact of their shots. And at least on the Death Star, I'd have to watch the movie again to see for sure, but like, whenever like Han or Luke or Leia are shooting, you don't get that. You don't get that violent intrusion into your sight of when the heroes are shooting. And that was a really interesting thing to me. I can only figure it's being done to give you that feeling, that visceral feeling of being in the middle of a firefight, so that it's like it's doing the only thing that it can do. It's, you know, intruding into your sight, into your vision, and giving you that strobe effect for just one frame. The way that the, you know, shootouts are shot in this movie, this, you know, A New Hope has the best shootout sequences of all the Star Wars movies. The rest of them, you know, like on Empire, they just look lazy and embarrassing. And, you know, there's that moment where there's a stormtrooper that's like almost waiting on its mark for, you know, Chewbacca to walk there on cue and shoot him. You know, so there's nothing of the same level of craftsmanship that goes into that. And even in like Jedi, you know, there's not the same variety. And like, you know, like in the prequels, you have some okay shot, you know, some decently shot things, but most of the creative energy is going into the duels, and that's perfectly fine for me. But I really like looking back on this one where, like, you know, you get, like, even, like, some bits where, like, you can see the animation of the laser blasts are going straight into the camera sometimes.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just a level of that that's really interesting on this movie.
Yeah.
And that's where I can see some of the experimental stuff that's going on in Lucas's head versus, you know, some of the more, like, traditional stuff. Like, but even when he's doing, like, his traditionally classically composed shots, I think that he pushes it, and this is something he definitely does in the prequels, much more so than he has an opportunity to do here. But, like, on this movie, you have some shots that are so classically composed that it goes beyond movies, and, you know, like, you almost have to just compare it to, like, you know, Renaissance art or something, just in the way that he's arranging pictures within pictures.
What would be an example of that?
The biggest example that I can think of is the extremely long shot on the Falcon, where Luke is on the foreground, left side of the screen, training with the remote. Background, a little bit more to the center, you have Chewie playing the chess with the droids. Extreme right side of the screen, background are Obi-Wan and Han watching Luke train and reacting in different ways. And in dead center, the circular empty hallway. And, you know, there's an, you know, it's basically a triptych the way that it's arranged. You can almost separate it cleanly within thirds of the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And just the way that you have, you know, the, you know, these three basic images that are being presented to you almost in equal proportions of the screen is really interesting. And it's the sort of thing that you don't see happening in too many, even in too many classic epic movies. Even, you know, in a classic epic movie, like the biggest example that I can think of that's sort of similar to this is, that one shot in Lawrence of Arabia where Lawrence is on one side, his first companion is on the other side, the well is between them, and in the distance you can just begin to see Sharif Ali riding up towards them. And even then, it's not, you know, as concretized in the geometry of the screen the way that you can, obviously, when you have more to shoot than a desert. And it's something that, you know, it appears again and again in the prequels, the way that he might shoot things, you know, using the geometry on screen to accentuate things and guide your eye. It's something that happens in the Clone Wars here and there. I see a lot of really effective, like, triptych compositions where you'll have, you know, character A over here on one side of the screen, character B on the other side of the screen, say in a hologram, and then behind and between them, two other characters that they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of like, it gives you a little bit of the same thing that, like, Orson Welles was knocking on when he did the deep focus photography of, say, Mama Kane and the banker in the foreground signing away little Charlie Kane's future, while in the deep background you can see him framed by the window playing with Rosebud.
Yeah.
It's, you know, that's the sort of thing. It's like, it's getting that spread across 2-3-5 proportions, and it's really impressive to me when you see that sort of thing. Like, you get the hint of it here, and it gets blown up in a lot of the other movies that he did. I don't think that you really see it that much in Empire, and especially not Jedi. Jedi is really lacking in that side. But even those, you know, you're furthest away from it of all when you're talking about, like, say, The Force Awakens. There's not even a hint of that. There's not even the afterbirth of that left over there.
Yeah. The least interesting thing to me, I think, is the mythos in the universe, really.
Mythos as in, like, the whole canon of the interconnected story?
Canon,
or
exactly.
Or,
yeah,
like,
all of
the
that
Joseph Campbell stuff.
And I loved that stuff as a kid. You know, I get why people are drawn to it and attracted to it. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there's 1.5 million things like that, you know? And maybe each thing is enjoyable on its own terms, but I don't think that's really what makes Star Wars distinctive, except in the fact that it kind of invented one whole cloth almost all at once in a way that other forms did. They evolved more slowly, or they kind of were rooted in earlier things that were more identifiable. Like,
well, what's interesting about the movie is that it becomes its own worst enemy in the fact that its success inspired so many imitators to its type, and so many other movies of the same similar form that eventually could figure out how to execute the same type of fantastical visions on screen with nowhere near the same type of actual, like, richness of imagination or ingenuity, but with better technical execution. Competent but unimaginative imitators, such to the degree that, like, right, it was able to inspire so many movies that you would have something, so many more movies that it would eventually have to compete with. Like, say, I remember when Independence Day came out. I loved Independence Day, but it was one of the first moments that I could recognize thinking, this is a movie that both looks better on one level and is actually kind of boring on another level, because it's not doing anything.
So it's just strictly aliens come and blow up the planet.
And it's a movie that I still like quite a lot. And, you know, I liked seeing the sequel to it with my sister and everything, but at the same time, it's not art in the same way that, you know, the original Star Wars or any of the Star Wars movies are.
And I'll clarify one thing too. When I say, oh, that it's the least interesting thing that it creates a universe, it's whatever, it's not exactly true, because I think one of the most interesting things is that it kind of creates its universe in a whole cloth. But the interesting part about it is that it's the whole cloth part, not the universe part. It's like not a factory film. That's what's about. Even the special effects, you can feel the touch of the people on it.
Yeah.
There's a perverse side to them. As much as I love Empire, at the same time, a part of me is just like, man, imagine if it just walked away after that one film and not let anybody else take it up, not been like, okay, now Disney, you make the feature. Like, what if it had been like E.T. or something, where he'd made the one blockbuster film that seemed to call out for more, but was just like, nah, it is what it is. And it's like, I feel like today it would almost feel more like what, in a way, it actually is, instead of being obscured by all of the hype that followed. It would be almost like a piece of pop art, you know, sort of semi-self-conscious, but also very sincere, and just, there's nothing else quite like it. You know,
well, I just mean that, like, in a narrative sense.
I wish it was almost, I put it as, I wish it was, like, the only blockbuster. Like, you only kind of need one. The rest are almost redundant. Like, one movie that's just this weird popcorn entertainment fusion of all this different genres. Like, kind of like the pipe dream of entertainment cinema. And this is the end result, and that's all you need. And the rest is, but instead it worked out complete opposite.
And that's how you have something like the new Star Wars, where it's basically just the set pieces of of 40 years ago, but with J.J. Abrams and Peter Jackson camera moves. What it feels like we have in The Force Awakens is not a natural continuation of the historical illusions. It feels more like we have, at best, the propaganda version of Iran-Contra. It feels like we're getting...
yeah, I love that analogy when you
made it.
It
feels like, you know, we have them saying, oh, we have bad guys to worry about again, but we're going to, you know, finance a plucky band of resistance, you know, freedom fighters to go take them on. It's sad to see the originality that was lost there, especially when you see how Lucas's trajectory in selling Star Wars basically took the same path as the fanboys who drove him to it, because where was he selling Star Wars? He was selling it to Disney. He was selling it to the place that he had all that nostalgic feeling for, and where he thought Star Wars was going to be safe. And that, you know, I think that at one point it did seem like he was arranging this deal so that, yes, he was getting Star Wars to another company and they were going to make the new movies.
Honestly,
but
he reenacted the plot of Revenge of the Sith. That's what he did.
Right, essentially.
So ridiculous. Like, he lived out the story he had written 10 years earlier. It's like...
And I think the thing is, he thought that he was going to have say over these movies in a much more bigger way than, you know, it turned out, obviously. But it, like, I knew that it was going to turn out this way simply because, and this just to tie everything back to the start of our conversation.
Yeah.
Who was running Disney, and who is running Disney now?
Right, Bob Iger. Who was
Bob Iger.
Of ABC with Twin Peaks.
Right, this is the man who strangled Twin Peaks in the bathtub, and now he is the man who has basically turned Star Wars into a crack whore.
And actually, also, this is the other thing. Force Awakens is definitely, far and away, the most conservative political film. You mentioned that with the Reagan-esque Iran-Contra thing, but even just in its conception of politics, like, I would say only the first film kind of comes close to that lack of complexity. And obviously, I've spent the whole time defending the first film.
I would say that the first movie, like, the original Star Wars, one of the things that I like about it is that even though you're not seeing a whole lot on screen, they're at least talking about the way the universe works. And they give you a very clear understanding of, you know...
That's one whole aspect. There's no mechanics.
You know that the Empire believes in small
things. And it is rebellious.
They believe in small
things. The characters are rebels.
Right. They believe, at the very least, that we know that, like, the Empire believes in state-run governments. We know that. We know that they believe in, like, you know, the regional governors have direct control of the territories.
Yeah.
And the thing that boils me up about Star Wars is sometimes I think people have seen these movies for so long and so many times that they don't even hear the dialogue anymore. It just becomes a kind of background music to them, and they don't realize that basically what Tarkin is talking about in that scene is what Republicans want for the country. They don't want a strong federal government. They want a strong military, and they want governors to run each of their states and come up with their own laws.
I wanted to ask you to get off a totally different subject now. Anyways, So yeah, I was curious to talk a little bit about the acting, because it's interesting when you're talking about James Dean. It's interesting to me, and you may defend it a little more, although I think you kind of have acknowledged, you know, hey, it's not, that's not necessarily a strong suit. I actually feel the acting in this Star Wars film is, like, more or less, I don't know what he's, what it, it's, like, fine. Like, it's, it works really well for what it is, and even on its own terms, it feels much more natural than what's in the prequels. And part of that might be by design, he's creating this sort of epic
texture
where people are going to be a little more stilted, and I know you've made that case. But I also think it has a lot to do.
It's definitely trying to do, like, the TCM type of movie, where a lot of it is going to be like that. But, yeah, there is lightning in a bottle in this movie in a way that few other movies have.
Yeah, and I think that's huge. I think it's the times in a lot of ways. Both him at that time still kind of, you know, maybe being more in a mode where he was sort of, I don't know if he was ever really comfortable directing actors, but maybe in a mode where
he was open to it, at least.
I think, to me, it seems like it was more just the actors themselves. I think they didn't take it too seriously, and they had a lot of fun with it, and they kind of knew how to mess around and kind of make it work.
While still being
true to what he, you know, what he intended.
I think Mark Hamill, in one sense, is the key glue that holds a lot of it together, because, you know, he hasn't done a whole lot as a live actor since then, but, you know, if you just look at his voice work, he can definitely commit to any type of, like, high concept thing that you want to throw at him. And, like, you know, a lot of people have said his best performance in his career has always been him as the Joker in the Batman stuff. And he's,
people have said that's the best Joker. I don't know if they still do with
Heath
Ledger. And,
people still go to him.
The absolutely brilliant, stunning work of Jared Leto. That's a joke.
but no, I mean, people still do go back to Mark Hamill's Joker for a reason, is that he does invest it with the right balance of humor and absolute terror that he, you know, and he's able to do that because he commits to the idea of the Joker in a way that other people haven't really, like, you know, as much as I love the Tim Burton Batman, and I do really love that movie, and I love Jack Nicholson's performance in it, but he's not really playing the Joker. He's playing Jack Nicholson as the Joker. And for that
Jack
movie,
Jack Nicholson and Cesar Romero makeup.
Right. But for that movie, that's fine. But it is nice to have somebody doing as close to the comic book Joker as you can possibly imagine.
Sure.
And it's that type of commitment to the role that I think in A New Hope really lets that core trio become the core trio that they are, even though they only spend, like, a third of the movie together. The movie takes so much time getting them together, then they only spend about a third of the movie together, and then they don't really spend all that much time together in the rest of the movies either. They basically spend a little bit of time together on Empire, a little bit of time on Jedi, but you feel like they spent, like, because of that one movie, you can feel the, like, possible imagined adventures that they go on, you know, off stage and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting for me to compare that to some of the, like, you know, the other trios that you have in the other trilogies. Like in the prequel trilogies, arguably you only have two movies with the core trio of Anakin, Obi-Wan, and Padme, because Hayden Christensen doesn't show up until, you know, the first movie, second movie.
Okay, that's an interesting point. That's the movie where you see them.
That's the movie where you see them. But what's also interesting to me is, like, when you consider Liam Neeson is really the lead character in the first Star Wars prequel in a way that, like, Alec Guinness wasn't in A New Hope.
Yeah.
So that when he dies in that movie, you've just lost the character who you've invested in the most in that movie.
That's a great point, yeah.
Yeah,
they're really...
I mean,
the kids like Anakin, I guess. Padme's kind of a question mark because you don't know who... Well, obviously, any person... First of all, any person who knows Natalie Portman, which everyone did then, knows what's going on. But theoretically, you know, you don't know who she is. Yeah.
But I mean, like, even like now in this new movie and this new trilogy, I don't think you technically do have a central trio. You don't have a central trio in the same way that you did in the past.
Well, they want to, but they haven't been together yet.
Right. People are projecting that onto them now. Right.
Definitely.
Because, like, at one point, one of the people in that trio was going to be dead. So, yeah, I don't know what to say about that there. I think it's interesting that you have people wanting there to be a trio, and I hope that there is a trio that stands with the same weight. But,
yeah.
we're not there yet. It's something that feels very manufactured in a way that was very naturally put together or just, like, naturally came together almost by itself in the original movies.
Yeah.
And at least in the prequels, was put together by an individual craftsman.
Yeah.
Right. And that's something that you absolutely, like, lack here. You have not something that came together, you know, by the hand of God, not something that came together by the hand of man, but now you have something that came together by fucking accident.
Yeah.
I don't know, it's like, that's one of the things that, you know, ultimately I'm going to miss the most about Star Wars now in the hands of Disney, because, you know, say what you will about the quality that they can produce, they are never going to do a movie that years later you're going to say they're, you know, you're never going to have a political movie from them, really.
Yeah.
You know, you're never.
Yeah, you'll have this sort of passive political movie, like Iron Man 1. That was such a. Did they own Marvel at that point?
No, but they've kind of gone into that direction a little bit with, like, Civil War, which you should see at the very least to be able to.
At some point, sure.
You should see it to see what they think of as a political movie. It isn't really. In fact, it's really just the same type of reactionary type of movie as, like, say, The Force Awakens is. It's just much more artfully done and coherently done.
Yeah.
But it's very much the work of a corporation, not the work of individuals. I don't know. I like looking at the movie to see how it gets made by its limitations, but it is telling that by, you know, The Empire Strikes Back, there are barely any changes in that movie in, like, the special edition version.
Yeah.
So that I am perfectly happy to let the, you know, the Death Star battle be opened up, and I'm perfectly happy to let, you know, Mos Eisley be opened up and things like that. Especially because, have you ever looked up this thing called, I think it's Star Wars... It's not the despecialized edition, or, like, there are all these, like, Star Wars fan edits.
I couldn't access it if somebody was pointing me to it.
Right, but there are all these Star Wars edits that I find now that aren't just trying to make the movies, you know, quote-unquote, the original movies. It's, like, trying to make their own preferred version of a special edition so that, like...
Well, like a fan edit, or...?
Like, a fan edit that includes loads of new special effects, just not the same ones that were done, like, there's one version of a, there's, like, one fan edit of the, of A New Hope, and I wish I could remember the name of it now, and I'll try looking it up, but, like, there's one fan edit of A New Hope that added a bigger, longer explosion for the Death Star, and... It was so big and so long that you had, like, a minute in between that shot of Tarkin before the Death Star explodes and the actual explosion. And what's so weird to me is that you have these people who want to preserve, who think that they're making a more, you know, who think that they're making a better version of the movie because they have Greedo not shooting his gun. But they lose one of the best edits in, I would argue, movie history. I think that shot of, you know, cutting from Tarkin to the Death Star exploding. That
is there a horse going by in the background?
No, that's a grocery cart.
Oh, okay.
But no, I mean, like, that shot of, like, Tarkin, you know, going from Tarkin to the Death Star exploding,
mm-hmm.
that to me is as good a cut as, you know, Lawrence blowing out the match. And it's like imagining somebody saying, oh, we're going to make our own new edit of Lawrence of Arabia, and like, we're going to add in an hour of Lawrence of Arabia before he goes to Arabia. That's what I think of, you know, and that's what being a Star Wars fan is like now. It's like being a fan of Lawrence of Arabia, but surrounded by people who don't really seem to like Lawrence of Arabia very much.
That's definitely a bizarre dynamic there, and it's funny being into Twin Peaks where it's and maybe that's how we can end it, kind of coming back to Twin Peaks, because I had another thing to say about it too, but it's weird being used to that, where it's like, oh yeah, you know, the original director doesn't come back, can't do anything, and this and that, and, you know, I get all the criticisms of me because I share a lot of them, but at the end of the day, I can understand not wanting new Star Wars. I can't understand wanting new Star Wars that has no connection to Lucas.
Yeah.
That just seems so perverse to me. I can't. Like, I get the idea of, like, you know what, leave well enough alone, blah, blah, blah. But, like, the taking the desire for it to become this corporate product
right.
is just weird to me.
What it feels like to me is, let's say, you have somebody who watched Breathless and fell in love with the movie Breathless,
yeah.
and then they go and watch, like, other Godard movies, and they hate
yeah.
them. And then they realize they didn't really fall in love with Breathless.
Yeah.
That's just the first time they saw Paris.
That's a great analogy, yeah.
Yeah. And that's
and that's
what we have now. We have a bunch
I've heard people claim, oh, Breathless is only good because Truffaut wrote it, which I think he wrote like a paragraph, like
right,
maybe three lines.
Right,
a guy shoots a cop. That is it.
Right.
They're like, oh no, that's only good because Truffaut wrote it. All of Godard's other film stuff.
Right. It's like
then
yeah,
he wrote it
in the same way that Matthew Robbins wrote THX. He provided a basic story and that was it. But no, it's like.
Yeah.
And, like, to elaborate that fuller, I would say, it's sort of like you would then have those same people who liked, who liked Breathless, then hate watching every other thing Godard makes, and then getting really happy when they see, like, I don't know, Amelie. Amelie,
yeah.
I guess, would be their Force Awakens, because it's like, oh, it's a beautiful movie about Paris, and it's, you know, French, and
yeah.
it's pretty, and it's all the things that I like, and none of the, you know, weird jump cuts and philosophical stuff getting in the way anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I feel now, and, like, as much as I like Amelie...
Jean-Luc Godard raped my, I don't even know what this. I don't even know where that analogy would go.
Yeah.
My whimsical adolescence, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Did you ever see The People versus George Lucas?
Nope, and I don't have any interest in it.
I'd be curious to hear your response someday if you ever managed to.
I
found it very interesting, but it was also kind of, you know, the partly, to a certain extent, the filmmaking, mostly the subject just exasperating at times, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, I could barely watch any of the, any of the Red Letter Media.
Well, those are on a whole other level of...
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I almost prefer to watch the things that are genuine. I almost prefer to watch the things that are genuinely offensive and terrible than the ones that are trying to cover themselves up. Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like,
Red Letter Media
is like the Klan, and People vs. George Lucas feels to me like David Duke. It's trying to take off the Klan robes and, give yourself a nice haircut, but
oh, wow.
It's still the same person.
Where are we going with this analogy?
Yeah.
So, to bring it back to the Twin Peaks thing, the last point was, I think, yeah, it's interesting for me, the phenomenon very much reversed in that there are people who watch a pilot of Twin Peaks and they're like, this is Twin Peaks, this is the high point. It's a little bit downhill from there, and the film definitely is like a very meager, disappointing, like, you know, follow through, because it's like, well, you know, the pilots are great because you don't know who killed her, and it's this big history, and everything's very tight and organized, and then, you know, the film is this messy. I mean, I totally disagree. I love the pilot. I think it's great, although I will say I think I admire it more than I am, like, you know, wrapped up in it the way I'm wrapped up in the finale or the killer's reveal and other episodes. I respect it, its craftsmanship. But the film, to me, that's like where I have the real emotional connection with. And I almost love the pilot for having born the film, for having made the film eventually possible. This total revelation where, you know, Lynch is totally subverting what people thought they liked about Twin Peaks. They're like, no, this is what Twin Peaks always meant. This is what it was about. You know, deal with it, and just radical and in your face. So that, for me, is what I value Twin Peaks. With Star Wars, the phenomenon's very, the parallels are very similar, but it flipped for me. I like that original product that's a little bit more potential, and that kind of anything could happen, and this is being created out of whole cloth, versus the later, which is also a prequel, you know, the later sort of chapter where it's like, no, this is the dark heart of Star Wars and subverting the tropes and in the face of fans and all of that. So it's weird, there's that interesting parallel there. I think for me, the reason it's a little reversed is I just feel, I don't feel Star Wars for me can totally live up to that, to the demand of like a psychological darkness and the sort of thematic complexity in the way that, that Twin Peaks could. I feel like its greatest strength is much more in the simplicity, whereas Twin Peaks, I think really the heart of it is that kind of dark complexity and everything. Now, that said, maybe because partly of that curious Twin Peaks, I can kind of see where you and other fans are coming from and why you would
feel like,
I get it, Star Wars and blah, 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 but man, it's the prequels that really interest me, or Revenge of the Sith or whatever, because it's like this. And I know you're a little different even than that, because you're a fan of Menace more than
Here's why for me, is because, you know, you mentioned the, like, the pop art aspect of Star Wars, and I feel like that's what the prequels actually do, in a sense. They take the beginnings of the pop art side that you had in, you know, the original Star Wars, and blow it up to such a degree that you are able to see conceptually the themes, which is why it's so interesting for me when you have, like, the homages break down in such a way that they become a kind of, like, self-referential code. In, like, Attack of the Clones, where you have the Blade Runner moment, the Harryhausen moment, the THX moment and everything, and it becomes not just, like, a cute little thing of saying, like, you know, it's not like Tarantino, where he's just sort of, like, having fun and saying, oh, I loved these movies when I was a kid, and, you know, but it becomes another way of saying that this is a society that is turning into a dystopia, and so is ours. You know, it becomes part of the core language of the film. And that's something that I really like about the prequels, that you don't have in the originals to the same extent, or at the very least, it's a bit harder to see that because so many of the references are more to genre rather than specific films. And I really like having that. Like, you know, I like, you know, the thing is, like, I love the way that, like, he's playing with conventions in the same way that, like, Godard did, but he's doing it in a much bigger canvas spread out to many more people. So obviously it's going to be a different experience than that necessarily. And I actually am much more the opposite in the way that I approach Twin Peaks too. Not because I don't enjoy all the stuff that you're talking about. I do, certainly. But more because my experience with the pilot, and I consider The Red Room dream to be part of the pilot.
Sure.
Because, you know, it was shot for
well,
that.
Well, production-wise, it
right,
was
production-wise.
Generally, I mean, it was a little distant, but it was closer to the pilot than the show. And
I mean, like, it was the same cinematographer, at least.
Yep, that's true.
Like, and what I love about that all there is, yes, that possibility, that, like, everything that was, like, being written about in that New Yorker review where they're comparing it to Bunuel, and it doesn't really work, but in one sense I look at it and say, it's kind of doing the Bunuel thing better than Discreet Charm was, at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
But,
well, I don't find Bunuel that visceral or shocking to me. It's more of like a almost intellectual, like, I know that there's something I'm missing there, because people watch and they're like, oh my god. It's,
yeah.
They talk about it like it's having this almost disorienting effect on them, but I get that more from, like, Maya Darren and Carto and all of those people than I do. Anyway, that's aside. Another tangent. But
what I like about the pilot of Twin Peaks is, like, the suggestion, the possibility. I always like a story when it's at its beginning more than as it's progressing sometimes. It's, you know, why I find myself, like, say,
interesting.
Like,
so we're in,
like,
flipped positions.
Right.
Because,
like,
your argument for Twin Peaks is much more my argument for Star Wars.
Right.
I will say this with Star Wars. While I celebrate the first film as, like, the best kind of piece of cinema of them all, I do respect that if he's going to keep doing Star Wars by making sequels, he does what I think is the wise thing to do with it. If you're going to try, instead of trying to repeat it and be like, here's another sort of almost...
Here's The Force Awakens.
Exactly. Instead, it's like, no, we're going to make this psychologically richer. We're going to make this... Force Awakens draws on those too, but it's drawing from, you know, Empire and Jedi and stuff like that. But to be like with Empire, okay, now if we're going to stick around in this universe... It's going to become darker. It's going to become more complex. The bad guy has to kind of become a good guy, and then that logic continues into the prequel. So I do respect that if he is going to make those films and become the Star Wars guy, that's the way he's going to do it. And that parallel certainly, that evolution certainly parallels both Evangelion and Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and the other thing that I'll say that's interesting for me is that, like, Twin Peaks and Evangelion become more and more interesting when they're on the seat of their pants.
And in terms of how they're created.
Right, and Star Wars really was only at the seat of its pants at the beginning.
Yeah, that's a great, you know what, that's a very interesting point. Maybe that's why I, yeah, that's totally true. That's the missing parallel as to why I like, I mean, among other things.
There is something interesting about how a movie like Revenge of the Sith could have begun almost without a script. And that's where, you know, the improvisatory, you know, chemistry comes in.
Right. Although, of course, you know, he just sat in a chair and drank coffee while J.J. Abrams runs around in the snow. Clearly an inferior director. That's also from the Plinkett video. It's a direct juxtaposition.
And there were no helicopters. I mean, look, I will admit that, like, it does, like, George Lucas does not fit the modern romanticized version of a director. Like, I feel like the most romanticized director that we have now is somebody like Steven Soderbergh, who has, like, built his whole reputation anew from Schizopolis as being this guy who not only directs his movies, but operates the camera, talks right, you know, is, like, right there with the actors. So it's like you have that perfect balance of the director as somebody who guides the actor and the director as the commander of the visual side of the medium.
Mm-hmm.
He's holding the camera, and then he's putting it down and talking to his actor. And that's what I feel like is the platonic ideal for a director nowadays. We want to believe that our directors are operating the camera like Soderbergh or Kubrick was.
And
anybody who just sits in their chair and drinks coffee is a schmuck.
Yeah.
And what's ridiculous about that to me is that there's this other concept of a director that I have that is more on the animation side of things, you know, the Miyazaki, the Hidekiano, or the Disney, if you will, the guy who does almost all, who does like 90% of the work in pre-production. Mm-hmm. And that's also what George Lucas was, even when he wasn't quote-unquote directing.
Yeah.
So that's what we have lost now. And now we
have. And I know you're not a huge fan, but that's the Hitchcock model, basically.
Right, and that's something that I really respect about Hitchcock, and I think that's also something that, like, that's what we have lost now on the Disney side of Star Wars, where you have a movie whose pre-production was basically just watching the original.
Well, I mean, it's funny, and I guess this, in a way, you know, this is maybe a little bit of a mea culpa in that I complimented this, or at least I was sort of amazed by it with Star Wars, where it's like, oh, he had the vision of the world before the story. But at least he was creating that world fresh for this movie. Fresh Force Awakens, that was completely what happened. They threw out Lucas's idea, and they said, we are scheduled. We're locked into a schedule to make this movie, and we have no clue what story we're telling.
Yeah,
now we're going to make a story to meet this production deadline.
And what's sad to me is that they come up with new planets that all look like the old ones.
Mm.
You know, that, and that's also one of the things that morally kind of upset me. Like, I understand that you can't go to Tunisia anymore and shoot Tatooine because, you know, it's a politically unstable region nowadays.
Mm.
So if you wanted to shoot on Tatooine, I guess you had to go to a desert. But one, does it have to be Abu Dhabi? And two, you know, where you have slave labor and things like that, and really, it's, you know, it's not a very morally nice proposition going over to shoot there. But also, if your planet isn't going to be Tatooine, why not just have it look different? I'd rather have, you know, The Force Awakens begin on a planet that looks like Detroit than looks like Tatooine.
Interesting point.
You know, get some union jobs.
Yeah. Good point.
All right.
And that's it for Star Wars, number 12 on the Wonders in the Dark Sci-Fi Countdown. And that's it for my contributions to the countdown as well. I'll be taking a break from Cinemaville for a while, but keep your eyes open at Wonders and Lost in the Movies to see more takes on movies and television. And please visit neowestchester.com to check out my webcomic, which I'm updating with whole stories full of action, adventure, and tax evasion on a monthly basis. Until next time, this is Bob Clark of Cinemaville reminding you, nostalgia isn't a black hole, but it is a flat circle.